to 5. I'm Tracy Donaldson with Ian Wishart on Radio Pacific.
Time to talk tough about the issues of the day. It's time to talk to Ian Wishart, in for Mark Bennett on Radio Pacific.
Yeah, rock and roll talk, back control, 25 away from 5 is the time, and this in the news today. New Zealand's highest paid abortion consultant earned $158,000 in Justice Ministry fees last year because they signed off more than 1,800 abortions. Most consultants are also employed by district health boards, some as salaried operating surgeons who perform abortions. So these doctors earn a salary from the health board for their full-time job, plus they get $87.50 from the Justice Ministry for approving each abortion as a consultant. How can you be employed for 8 hours a day on a salary, and during that 8 hours a day, you also act as an abortion consultant and you get paid on top of your salary for doing something within your 8 hour job? How on earth does that work? $158,000 for approving 1,800
metres. Magnus Benro racing.
1,200 the journey. You're racing now. Good start to Daiquiri, a trifle slow over on the outside. And one of the first to bound out was Contender right there.
Welcome back, come in, Wishart. This is Radio Pacific. So yes, just continuing this little brief diversion on the abortion industry. The Justice Ministry paid out more than $3.5 million in consultancy fees last year. But the thing that gets me, and this is the point, it's double dipping. How can you be employed on a salary as a doctor for an 8 hour workday, 52 weeks of the year, and during your 8 hour workday for which you are already being paid a six-figure salary, you get paid a further $158,000 in clipping the ticket fees. Christchurch Dr. Pippa Mackay, who performs abortions at Canterbury District Health Board's Lyndhurst Clinic, says the health board salary and ministry fees to approve abortions are for separate jobs. That's what she says. Phil Goff, on the other hand, is unconvinced. And is looking into it. Stunning. Absolutely stunning. It is 21 minutes away from 5. We'll talk to David. Hello.
Yes, hello, Ian. Just a little bit on defence and a little bit on immigration. Defence-wise, we've got a government that has really got away lightly because of indifference and a lack of interest and therefore apathy and knowledge in respect of large numbers of the public. Our defence is ideologically driven, not strategically driven. In other words, it's not based on our geographic and strategic reality, but ideology, a particular assumption and a world view, which is primarily, see, the peacekeeping role. So the thing is then, having scrapped the Air Force strike wing and having failed to upgrade the Orions, we have an Air Force that can't fight. It can't actually fulfill, as most thinking people would see the role of an Air Force, the primary function of an Air Force. So you have an Air Chief of Staff, he has all the uniforms and all the paraphernalia, and he's been in there and he's risen to the top of his profession. His only problem is at the end of his career he doesn't actually have an Air Force. So one third of our Defence Force has in fact been disarmed. And everything I'm saying is factually correct. Having done this, mate, you would have thought that they would have pulled out all the stops in regard to the Hercules and the helicopters. Mm. Cunningly, they sold to a gullible public, in the main, a package involving spending several hundred million dollars to renovate C-130 Hercules that are already approaching 40 years old. They are the oldest serving Hercules in any military service in the world, to stretch them out another 15 years. And similar, we haven't seen much action in regard to the helicopters. Speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Keep skating to the nth degree, and it's sold to the public. And that is the New Zealand defence position, because they see no value in maintaining a deterrent stance. They see no value in real cooperation with our friends and allies and having the ability to make a contribution in terms of regional forward defence. That's because it's an ideological point of view. It's ideologically driven. Now, could I just say on immigration that, and I think you've mentioned this, I believe really we're talking about compatible immigration. We're talking about scale, because it doesn't take much between the years to realise, and you did point this out, that say over 10 years, if we were completely to source our immigrants from sources that were essentially foreign in terms of our traditions, then you have absolutely changed the character of your country. You've changed New Zealand, you've changed its identity, you've changed its structure and its soul. So really we're talking about scale and we're talking about compatibility.
Mm.
And certainly there are traditions and historical influences out there that are simply not harmonious with our history and our background and our traditions. And so really, Ian, until you work through this whole area of who we are as a people, what are our core values and principles, the things that we really believe in, that we hold to be of value, and also stemming from that, therefore, what value does New Zealand have to New Zealanders? And so really we're speaking here of those influences that go into creating a nation, and you've got to have those things, and we are weak in that area.
Yeah, we are. I appreciate that point, David. Thank you for raising it. I mean, the other issue that goes along with that is very much one of a recipe. If we're going to go down, I'll come back to it after the race. Thanks for calling.
Magnus Van Roo Racing.
Ready? And racing, Miss Cheeky's out nicely, so too is Maria Hanover. They're followed out there by Mad Brew, getting around the outside. Red King, further back we go to Cecilia Jess, and they're followed.
Get on the car phone, talk to Ian Wishart, in for Mark Bennett on Radio Pacific, and let out some steam.
And we're talking to Greg, hello.
Yes, hello, Ian. Going back to your conversation yesterday with about the actor Reese commenting on what's going to happen in 20-odd years when Muslim cultures become more dominant in Europe.
Yep.
Because we can go back to our own history in New Zealand, where back to 1840, where Maoris was the most dominant dominant culture, and they would have laughed in saying that Pākehā would have become dominant.
So yep.
We can look at that. Essentially, I think there's two different... If you look at Western civilization and Arabic Muslim civilization, there's two different concepts here that won't meld together. Do you see where I mean? I'm coming from there.
Yeah.
With the Western civilization, you have the.
What I was going to say before the break, and which I think is pertinent to this conversation, is that if we go down the track of saying, okay, well, let's have more immigration, which is what I'm in favour of, then I think we need to look at the issue as one of a recipe. And the recipe is that you use immigration as seasoning, as spice, not as, I mean, if you're cooking a meal, right, you don't put an entire bucket of chili peppers into the mix and expect to have any sort of other taste come through. All you're going to have is chili peppers. So, but on the other hand, one chili can give a nice touch of seasoning. So what we have as a country, we have a melting pot of cultures here already. The issue is to say, okay, what's the perfect balance? Let's keep the ratios secure. So, okay, if we're saying we want a population of, 60% Anglo-Saxon, 20% Māori, et cetera, you know, whatever the ratios are. But you break it down and say, okay, let's mix our culture up a bit, but maintain a certain ratio so you don't lose the mix, because if you go over the top and you bring in, you know, 5 million immigrants from China, let's say, then one thing you won't have at the end of that is a New Zealand that you recognise.
Exactly. My point was that with the Arab civilization and the Western civilization, I see a lot of concessions given by Western civilizations towards what Arab culture should be, but I never see anything coming back from the Arab culture towards Western civilizations. It's always there's nothing from them. It's absolute from them.
Well, it is absolute, but the reason it's absolute is because the Quran teaches absoluteness.
I think that's the difference. If you look,
but the Bible teaches absoluteness as well, but
to the point of the individual.
Yeah, it's still your individual choice as to whether you do it, whereas the Quran basically says this is your instruction and all men must bow. So
that's why Islam is still ruled by the pulpit, and we're going our own way, and that's why I think there's so much antipathy out there. And I think what's going to happen in the next 15 years, and when the oil runs out, and the Arabia and that, what's going to happen then?
Lord knows, quite literally.
That's what I'm thinking of the next 20 years. So, actually, as a white middle-class male,
yeah,
I'd probably be okay under Islamic rule because it's more patriarchal than anything else. So I think all these people that are saying, oh, no, you mustn't upset them, I think in the next 20 years they're all going to be down the road.
Well, yeah, that's right. Hey, you probably...
That's another point of view to think about.
Learn some Arabic, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. 0800 309 399. In fact, the only spare line is 09 309 3099. If you want to debate these or any other topics at all, feel free to give us a call. There is just one spare line. I'll give you the number again. 09 309 3099. Also, I see in the paper too, a child playing with a cigarette lighter in a car almost caused a triple fatality in Masterton yesterday. Three children were pulled from the burning car in a supermarket car park by passers-by. The mother had just dropped off the groceries and ducked inside to pick something else up for a minute, and the children set fire to the car. Have you had a close shave like that? What can you tell us? Going up to the news. Hunters and collectors, they haven't heard this in years.